Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Michael Silverblatt, who will be interviewing Jim and is going to introduce him. I'm sure many of you know Michael. He is the host and guiding spirit of KCRW's half-hour radio show Bookworm, where he introduces listeners to new and emerging authors along with writers of renown. And I think guiding spirit is a wonderful term for Michael because he cares so deeply about literature, about writers, and the entire culture of writing. He reads deeply and widely and is able to guide us to new understandings of an author's work. We're very happy to have Michael here, as we always are. So please welcome him, and he will be introducing the inimitable and influential Jim Crusoe. Thank you very much.
Are you ready to watch this? This is the most extraordinary thing. I've never known a podium that does this. I suspect it could go up to the ceiling. This is going to be an informal and joyous night for which I have worn a brand new jacket. I'm talking about someone who I've known for 28 years. Just shortly after I moved to Los Angeles, I met Jim Crusoe at a party. I don't know what it was, but he was the only person at the party that I really wanted to talk to. And part of it was his look. He has a hangdog expression, and when younger, he looked a lot like Anthony Perkins. I being drawn to psychopathic types, I made it my business to only be around him. We talked about Weldon Keyes, a virtually unknown poet who gets revived every so often, but never permanently. He remains a permanently unknown writer who one day disappeared off the Golden Gate Bridge. That is suspected. His car was found. He was not. Jim and I shared a lot of tastes. He introduced me to a lot of his favorite writers. I introduced him to mine. Our conversation has lasted for years. I thought just because of the informality of it, no one remembers really that Jim began as a poet with a book called The History of the World. Before that, there was a little pamphlet I didn't bring with me called Juju. I'm telling you this because I think all of you should start to collect Jim Crusoe because he's, it's taken a while, but he's coming fantastically into his own. He got reviewed in the New York Times book review with his last book. You know, we've all been waiting for people to make the discovery that we all made, most of us here. I see a lot of faces I know, and I hope at the end you'll all come and say hello to me because I don't think we've spoken in years. I also want to say that I have great respect and reverence for each of you, for being here. It's a great pleasure. The second book of poetry was Small Pianos. There was a tiny book that had the letters of the alphabet in it. I don't know if you'll ever find this anywhere. It's kind of hard to find. Then I have this Hotel de Dream. There's one I don't have here called Abduction. For those of us who are collectors in the audience, I like to have things in galleys. This is a galley of his novel, Iceland, that came out from Donkey Archive. Look at this. Oh my God, here's Jungle Girl, a wonderful book of poems. It was the first one on which, this is a detail from an Henri Rousseau painting that illustrates the cover, just as a detail of a Bosch painting illustrates the cover of the new book, Erased. A book with funny drawings in it called Blood Lake. Then the last book, Girl Factory, and there's another, where did it go? I didn't bring two different books. Is that possible? Oh my goodness. Well, you know, hell, you know, we live in trying times. No, I think this is everything except Juju. And the new book is called Erased. You know, when we first met, and it may be a sign of the times, we liked funny, creepy books, like kind of the prototype of the funny, creepy book is Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts. But, you know, we also, of course, like Kafka. And maybe at that time, creepiness was possible. Right now, it's really, you know, we're living in such difficult times, and maybe we don't enjoy creepiness as much as we once did because it's all around us, because we live in it, and because we're suffering through many different kinds of cultural creepiness. And so Jim's work has become, I think, funnier and funnier, although I know he wouldn't agree with me, but I think he's, you know, a virtuosic comic writer with metaphysical underpinnings. What he has is, these two are two-thirds of the way through a trilogy. I think, you know, I've never asked him directly, but I think it's a trilogy whose themes primarily have to do with men and women, or a man and the feminine spirit. Girl Factory had girls who are encased in large columns of yogurt. maybe some don't find this funny, but you know, it was odd, and the book works very hard to keep its creepiness at bay, although it is a version of Bluebeard and his wives. Erased follows a man trying to find his mother. He is trying to find her, although she abandoned him when he was a child. She abandons him again. She disappears. In trying to find her, I think this is the novel, certainly the American novel, with the most scenes taking place at women's clubs, various kinds of Kiwanis, Rotarian, Lions. In fact, in the Cleveland, where much of the book takes place, the Rotarians and the Lions have joined together to form the Rotary Lions, whose emblem is a lion with wheels. And almost all of the women's clubs here end up in the suggestion that the world is not the world we know, that neither the past, nor the future, nor the present are what we think of them. And Jim is, in his writing, out to prove that fact. He is never boring. You never go for more than a page or so without saying, how did he think that up? You know, he's so inventive. I don't know. I can't explain. Maybe we'll find out a little bit tonight how he knows whether his odd mixes are working, you know, how much time to spend on things. He's a master of pacing. He's a master of complicated sentences that you can nevertheless read easily. Somehow ease, directness, is part of what he does. Now, I want to tell you a truth, which is, you know that sound I make on the radio when you hear me on Bookworm and you feel like, oh, I love him. I want to love him. I want to know him and know him better and love him. That's a sound that I first heard Jim make at the podium of Beyond Baroque. I'm sort of making it now. The sound comes from the voice. It's a way of speaking out loud while whispering. And I think it's very seductive, but more than seductive, I think it says what I mean it to say. I don't know what he means it to say, but when I took it from him, what I meant it to say was, I love you and I want you to care about the things I care about as deeply as I do, and I trust you to care. I trust you to reawaken that part of yourself that really once cared about the imagination and what it can do and how it can change the world and change the self and allow us to live a better life than might seem to be humanly possible in our times. I'm very grateful to Jim because he gave me my radio voice, and I want us all to welcome him. Begin by swinging these things toward us.
That's bastion of creepiness. Thank you, Michael. That's good.
Okay. Let's start. I am curious. You're a man, to my knowledge, who's always been liked by women.
I like women, okay.
Yeah. How did this trilogy of women issues and women problems take shape in your mind?
Yeah, well, it's women are important in that I think that, well, there's two things going on. First of all, the trilogy really isn't about men and women. In my mind, the trilogy is about crossing the line between alive and dead, and where you draw that line.
Same deal.
Yeah. And thank you. And I think women for me represent the better other, and so if you know my characters, most of them are fairly hopeless guys, and they try, but they can't succeed. And in a certain way, I like the idea of, in my mind, of the woman being perfect. It's not true, but I like that idea.
Now, despite this, nevertheless, the women are not necessarily worshipped in these books. They're, in vats of yogurt and things of this sort. Explain.
Well, they are worshipped in vats of yogurt. Why couldn't that be possible? It might even make it easier. Come on, Michael. in funny ways, I think, and this is maybe to go too far, but in some ways I'm really interested in the ideal of the woman in the sense that Nabokov talked about the unattainable ideal that he keeps coming back to over and over again. And so that you have a bunch of guys who are inept, who try to do their best, essentially who represent some fairly large percentage of my id, striving for something, and so they're striving toward that.
Do you think that the unachievable is in some way the subject of fiction?
That's a good question. I think the unachievable is the subject of my life. And fiction sort of pales beneath that, but But the impossibility of life and the possibility of doing enough and the possibility of actually helping anything seems to me almost, I mean, it's odd. I was sitting on a lawn in Reed College, and it was a beautiful Portland day, green grass, you know, and I had been with a group of people, and I was left to myself for about 20 minutes, and it was amazing how fast I could sink into complete despair. Despair over not over what? Everything, you know, of what we are, what I am, how hopeless it is, all that sort of thing. So I don't even know where that question started, Michael. but yeah, I think the unachievable is what life is about, honestly.
Yeah, because, you know, at least I found myself saying today, you know, strangely, usually the summer is the time when writers aren't coming through Los Angeles, but somehow or other, I'm getting calls every day. Would you like to talk to so-and-so? Would you like to talk to such-and-such and this one or that one? And I found myself, because it's so hard to say no, I've taken to saying no in thunder. And I found myself telling a publicist, you know, I'll take a look, but it's unlikely because I'm sort of indifferent to realistic fiction about families. And I kind of am. That is to say, I, as a reader, I don't care about people. I care about them in life very deeply, but in writing, I care about how a story is told, and it almost doesn't matter what the story is. If it's told well and told deeply and told with beautiful or ugly words, but if somehow the writer has moved the subject to what you do on a page. I know, too, that you are against boring a reader with what is already known. Can you speak about that? Because I think it's one of the hardest things for people to understand, especially right now, somehow that idea that you need to identify with characters has come back in spades. And you're not wrong. It's not, if you do identify with characters or if as writers you want to create moving, realistic people, please don't take my words as deterring you. But there is another way of going about it, and I think that Jim's work is one way of representing another way of going about things.
Yeah, that we should talk more about why you think, I agree with you, why you think naturalism is kind of coming back. But for me, it's almost a desperation to find, the one thing I think that I can hold up against despair and sadness is the idea of wonder and the idea of surprise. And in some ways, what I do seems to me almost frenetic at times. But and certainly in Cleveland, Cleveland was deliberately conceived here as a palette for a wonder book, for you know, which I was raised in Cleveland, certainly didn't exist while I was there. So this is creating a Cleveland that offered things that were surprising, that gave me reason to move every day. And it's important for me to use these things for myself, to sort of make them carrots for me. But also, it sounds funny, but one of the things that seems important is for me is to leave a book or leave a world in a slightly deranged way, in a way that the world at the end of it has, the book at the end of it has something I didn't know existed before I started it. And I remember day after day after day growing up in the Midwest in Cleveland and people telling me that this was the world and how happy I was to be there And they kept calling it the best location in the nation. And I kept thinking, if this is the best, I mean, I was like 12. If this is the best location, why isn't the nation here? You know, why are people avoiding this place? So there was this strange world. And it only became, when I came to Los Angeles, oddly enough, was where the sort of the Book of Wonders started to open for me.
Now, in the Cleveland as it exists in Erased, well, it's a city of happy people, at least when the winter is over, and most everyone, including children, practices an art of one kind or another. In fact, some are said to be practitioners of rhyming sculpture.
You like that, I remember that.
Yeah. In parentheses, not a good idea. Would you be happy in a place where people were happy and everyone was an artist?
Yeah, I would. And oddly, I mean, in a way, this is kind of crazy, but with the groups of writers that I work with, those are my happiest moments, is sitting in a group with people I know who write and talk like they're interested in things, sure.
I, by the way, always, you see, I happen to think that Jim is one of the best teachers of writing in the world, not just in the city. And whenever someone asks me where to go study, I always say, oh, skip all those writing programs. Start out with Jim Crusoe. He's generous and funny and gentle and
cheap.
You're not cheap. Your classes are inexpensive. I mean, you're very generous. I never experienced cheapness at your hands. What does it take to be a good writing teacher?
Well, I don't think it takes a lot, honestly. I mean, I think it takes, it's everybody in class is, to my mind, everybody in these groups are good writing teachers. And the really the thing that it takes is to appreciate what people do well and try and figure out how to make a work better. That's it. To sort of praise the good and then to say, what's the next level? And it doesn't take much beyond that.
You seem to be able, as many teachers might not be, to see your students publish work without feeling envious of them. You know, when everyone is somewhat at the same level, when someone breaks out, it usually busts a workshop up when someone starts to publish. The level of vanity, arrogance, you know, all the things that happen. How do you do that? How do you manage?
I don't know. When I started out, I was that way. When I started out in workshops, there was the sort of idea that there were only maybe 7 chits, you know, and if someone else got one, that meant that my chance was diminished. So I would sort of sit resentfully in the corner, you know, giving kind of begrudging praise, that sort of thing. But of course, it works opposite that. The more good writing there is, everyone's level is raised. And so, I mean, I don't know how I do that because I don't. It's simply taking pleasure in what people do, and you know, people who write well are giving you a present. So why would you be envious of getting a present?
Well, it was only once I began to acknowledge that I am myself not a writer that I began to feel that constant thrill of about what people are doing and you know, mm-hmm. how they're doing it. But I think, you know, when I remember the first time you brought to Santa Monica College, a writing conference, I ran into not one, but 3 different young writers who were in tears with the need to meet or talk to this or that famous writer and feeling, I just lost my chance. He didn't like me. I had my conference. They didn't like the work. I'm asking this because, you know, the world of rejection is very much behind the novels as well. And somehow being able to skate through the horrors of the world seems to me to be a specific Crusoe ability.
Well, it helps never to have gotten any kind of early recognition, for one thing. So it makes you very patient. But I just got back from, again, yesterday, I was up in Reed doing a conference, and the interesting thing about it was that everybody, all the questions, this was a conference, a little panel on editing books, and all the questions were, how do I get published? What do I do? Who do I see? You know, and nobody asks, how can I actually make my work better? It's almost as if the work, people are maneuvering to sneak their work in or something like that. And the person who helped me along this, and I have to say I was like that too. I mean, I was full of envy and, you know, and pettiness, and still am. But the person who helped me was Amy Gerstler, the really, really fine poet from Los Angeles, one of the finest poets in the country, to my mind. And Amy is also one of the most humble, in certain ways, people I know. And she would talk about her poetry or her work as there's so much to do. To write a good poem is so impossible that I only hope I could come a little closer. And so the emphasis is not on publishing a poem or anything. It's trying to do a good job. And that's so difficult. That seems to be at least all I can pay attention to.
By the way, for you and for everyone else, I just got a catalog from Viking Penguin yesterday. Amy has a new book coming out.
I know, yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah. It's called Dearest Creature. It's from Penguin, as her last several books been. So if anyone wants to be looking out, Dearest Creature by Amy Gerstler. You've become something of a darling of what I think as to be the up-and-coming set of publishers. I think that by and large, the writing I most care about is coming from presses outside New York and who may have existed for a while, but who are more open to open forms, as we call them. Those include Donkey Archive, which has existed for a while, Tin House, which is relatively new. But there are a lot of brand new presses, and they seem to be McSweeney's, even, catching things just as they fall off the tree. Do you have hope for the situation in publishing changing?
I don't know. I have hope whether it's going to happen or not. I don't know. The interesting thing about this sort of new paradigm for publishing is that the way these presses largely work is the reason that they can make it is, which I'm not a bit opposed to, is they pay virtually nothing in advance. So you get very little money in advance, and you don't really get much afterwards either, which is okay. because you don't, again, you're not writing for money. So I think that it makes them a lot more flexible. They can publish a book, kind of break even, and move on, as opposed to these big presses where they have to get blockbusters. And what I do is never going to be, I don't think, a blockbuster. You know, it's not in the cards.
Well, I wouldn't be that sure of that, Jim. I mean, but then again, you know, I think of the things that I do on my show as being hugely interesting, and to publishers, when I tell them that I'm not interested in most writers who are on the bestseller list, they're just astonished. But let's talk about that, because I strangely think it's a literary subject, and I've never spoken about it before. I think, you see, somehow or other, during the late 60s, when I came into consciousness, I didn't really know money existed. I mean, it did, but it sort of went without saying. There were a lot of scholarships to schools then. There were a lot of writers in advance for one of the exciting new books, say, by John Barth or Donald Barthelme. I'm just thinking of writers of that period. Never were much more than $10,000 or $15,000. Never. Now I hear about, you know, writers who get six or seven figure advances. It's disappearing. But can you describe with me what it's like to live as if money didn't exist, as if it were somehow the domain of elves and pixies to leave pots of gold around? You know what I mean? Because
sure.
I don't think we write for money. I don't think that the valuable writing has ever been done for money. That's a lie, because Dickens was very concerned about his contracts with publishers. Many people, it's an eternal battle, but there is something. Susan Sontag once said, "Of course I don't have an agent. Did Kafka have an agent?" And then eventually she got the same agent you have, Jim, who's one of the flintiest in the business. But did Kafka have an agent? And do I think a writer has to live as if that world did not exist, at least while the writing is going on? And it's hard to do. How do you do it?
Well, I was trained as a poet, which makes it really easy to exist without that kind of idea of getting anything at all. I mean, my favorite story about working as a young writer is actually the example of Dennis Cooper, who, when he had his literary magazine, his kind of great literary magazine called Little Caesar, the way that Dennis would publish the magazine and the way he would distribute it would be that he would sneak into bookstores and hide it on the shelf and then sneak back out again without ever even talking to anyone. I got zero money, obviously, from poetry, and nor did I, but no one ever expected it. I existed for about 10 years working at Beyond Baroque, which in those days, didn't have any grants. We just worked, and the way we did it was that I would I would work at a job like setting type or somewhere that would someone would write you a paycheck, and then I would quit the job. And Beyond Baroque, the nonprofit foundation, would hire me for one day, and then they would fire me so I could get unemployment. and so I would, you know, an unemployment would last for 3 months, and then I would take another job, and then work for a little bit, get hired, fired, and I did that for about 10 years. It was very pleasant. Yeah, but there wasn't big bucks in it either, you know. But this is such, maybe, I don't want to sound cranky, but I think the culture is a lot more material than it used to be, and so that people judge themselves by what they own, by what they can buy, how much money they got on this deal or that deal, and that seems totally irrelevant to me still.
Well, that's kind of what I would like to talk about, because it seems to me that when I read a book, the books I really like take place somewhere as if money didn't exist. In other words, I'm trying to escape into a rabbit hole where the conditions of the material culture around me no longer exist. And I want to read in cozy, happy recollection of a world which, however horrible, was not all about possessions. And since we're, economically, obviously, hightailing it again, toward a world where we'll have less and less, probably. Maybe books are instruction manuals to remind us of how to live in such a world and have values other than those. And I know that writers can't really think about this. I mean, I have met in my time writers who, you know, like Mailer, just talked about the bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, James Salter, who, you know, is a minor writer, he is a major stylist and a major creator of fiction. He'd talk about Irwin Shaw and how a Shaw book would get on the bestseller list. And I was sitting there behind my microphone going, but what you write would never be that, you know, it's too brilliant and beautiful and good to ever be economically.
Yeah, the kind of writing I care about, and maybe you do, is this writing that my small and not very original theory is that writing is a form of a guided waking dream. That the narrator, as I always say, is like a dream character. They're driven by something, they're helpless largely, and they don't know what's going to happen. And the point of that only being that I don't think that we generally have dreams in which we acquire possessions. I don't think you buy a BMW in your dream, I hope, you know, that sort of thing. And certainly if you buy a BMW in your dream, you immediately crash it. So I think it's back to that strange naturalistic impulse of writing, that it's somehow a world. I don't think writing is connected with the world we live in. I think the writing is connected with a sort of a psychic thought, and it doesn't have to do with everyday life, nor should it necessarily. It can, that's fine, but okay. It's not what I value.
This seems to be an essence. So if one dreams to escape from the exigencies of the world, and if writing is a dream, how does one go about dreaming while awake at a desk writing?
Well, you don't escape from the world because, as you know, with dreams are what happens in the world that simply are reconfigured and exaggerated. So it's not an escape. It's like an alternate view and perhaps a clearer one. How do you do it? How do I do it? I don't know. Honestly, what I try to do is start with an image that bothers me. Maybe it is a dream image. It can be a moment that bothers me, and then just to keep it going and keep it extended and keep myself surprised. And honestly, I can't write. I mean, the other big secret is the reason I like dream fiction so much is I can't write the other stuff. If I could, I certainly probably would, but I can't.
It's very interesting to me. A writer that I like very much, Marilyn Robinson, when she wrote Housekeeping, she wrote that kind of book, how to say it, that gets written as if money didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
The characters, while they have houses, they're virtually homeless in various ways. And she said that she couldn't write that kind of book a second time, although she tried to and wanted to, that it would seem to her mannered. And so she took up that kind of realist fiction. But once again, she's writing about priests, so that money and materialism, if not non-existent, are sort of on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
But there is the question of, you know, one doesn't want about this dreamlike writing to call it fantasy, because somehow or other it's at a higher level.
Urgent, I hope.
That's what I mean. Yeah. How does one introduce urgency into something like the dream or the fantastic imagination, which can solve any problem at a stroke without reference to the necessary or the urgent.
Well, there's a nice distinction I talk about, and some people have heard this, between fancy and imagination. And fancy is the stuff that you think of that is like fantasy. It's not connected to you as a person. It's an embellishment. It's something that's, wouldn't it be fun to imagine? The imagination for me has to do with the individual, and in this case, it's that id, and the id, my id, is unteachable, only wants what it wants, and the name of the id is actually urgency, right? So that it goes through these forms over and over again. And if you think of dreams that you've had, certainly dreams I've had, dreams are about being late to a place, forgetting things, about being pursued, about trying to grab something and you can't get it. Those are not fanciful dreams. Those are the most compelling in some ways. So I can, at least in my mind, and of course I use the first person for the most part, but I can reproduce that over and over again for myself because those problems are perpetually insoluble.
Just to be, you know, like this, I want to live in a world to get, let me take this from the top, okay? When I was young, I met people who were called intellectuals and they seemed to really know everything. I mean, they were extraordinary. And I wanted to grow up to be like them, and I am as much like them as I can be. But they don't, by and large, exist anymore. The figures who knew everything died and didn't leave behind successors, by and large. It's quite extraordinary. But because I want to inspire anyone and everyone in here to become a person who knows everything, I would want to point out that that distinction between imagination and fancy comes from a writer and poet named Samuel Coleridge in his Biographia Literaria. Coleridge was one of those people who thought everything it was possible to think about aesthetics and literature. Every time I have an idea that I think is brand new, I'll find it. If it's not in the Biographia Literaria, it will turn up in one of Coleridge's notebooks. So I just wanted to say that if you ever want to watch thought breathing, thought as a natural process of life, thought as how we live, thought as waking dream, Samuel Taylor Coleridge is your writer. And for him, that waking dream quality, which he knew very well, was fueled by opium. And since we're living in a culture that not only seems to be stimulated by drugs, but at times drugs now seem to be the only way that people live outside the culture, I wonder what you say to yourself and others. We were just commenting the other day, Jim and I, that we hadn't done an illegal substance in as long as we could remember. This wasn't to be virtuous, it just stops happening at a certain age. But what are you saying to writers about that impulse? And what relationship does narcosis have to the act of writing?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't say much about that to anything, except that my big advice to illegal substances is in stories is that the illegal substance should never be the cause for the action. It can be the background of the action, but if it's a real action, it's got to have another meaning to it than that. I don't know. The writer that I associate most with illegal substances is Philip K. Dick, and I can't read him because he makes me feel like I'm on a really bad trip every time I read him. I sort of get claustrophobic and nervous, you know.
Oh, but that's really interesting, actually, Jim, because similarly, William Burroughs is a really bad trip, and a certain sphere of writing has as its power its ability to put you on a really bad
and
he, trip.
And Burroughs works.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why.
But bad trips.
Confined, claustrophobic, unable to move, unable to free oneself, unable to go anywhere new. In that sense.
Now, since these books are not, as I said, about men and women, but about crossing the boundary between life and death, mm-hmm. is that a bad trip?
No, it's an interesting one. I mean, and the question is, and this is not, you said earlier metaphysical. My metaphysical questions aren't very complicated, but they're there. And one of them is, where does one thing start and another thing end? And you can apply it to life and death. You can apply it to a million other things. And I don't know that I have the answer. I know I don't have the answer. Nonetheless, it's a compelling question. So what? I think basically to write with your heart and write with your needs and do what you can do and not beat yourself up for doing not being able to do other things.
Where do your parents come from?
Hungary, both of them.
And Eastern European writing is very much of an inspiration for you.
Well, I don't know if it's inspiration, but the music certainly was. You know, when I was growing up, I went to about a zillion Hungarian weddings. And if you know Hungarian Hungarian music, it's all manic depressive. You have this fabulously frenetic moment, and then it goes down into this melancholy. And just when you think it's going to sink, it kind of hoists itself back up again. And Bartok does it too. And that's, I mean, in a way, that's what these books do, it seems to me, too.
Because I was wondering, so much of what's being done now by young writers is the writing of, let me see, again, I would say the problem is that the writing is often about immigration. The good thing is that it's about the immigrant imagination. In other words, changing setting, changing the location of mental values. The process itself, the realism of it, all too similar. You know, the story of getting the green card is not as good a story as the story of freeing the imagination, you know, from its place. There have been those who said, I mean, I don't know why everyone was upset, for instance, when the Nobel Committee said no one in America is doing writing of global significance. Because certainly it's very hard right now. Once it was possible, not just once, at many points in our literary history, it was possible to say, answer the question, what is the American novel about? The American novel is about pursuing the ineffable Moby Dick, or the American novel is watching the American dream go to pieces, all of late 50s writing. Mm-hmm. The American novel is about trying to set up an actual literature as opposed to a sociology, the writing of the mid to late 60s, say, beginning with Hawks and Pynchon. Is it possible that right now America has so little identity that one has to go back to other roots to create a meaningful imaginative gesture?
I think that's an interesting point. I think so. I mean, we're in a funny place. You know, what America seems to need to say, what American writing seems to need to say right now is this, and the only message seems to me, this is who I am. I exist. And there's and it's only that thick. It's just, I am who you see. I do exist. And it doesn't like to ask questions. It doesn't talk about multiple existences. And the thing I think that many times we hunger for in immigrant writing and other writing is questions about what's the line between the past and the present. You know, I mean, where are the lines? But we don't do that. We just say, here I am.
Yeah. Because, you know, there are people whose dreams I'd be afraid to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, dreams are, by definition, every dream isn't worth writing about, you know. And in fact, dreams, you know, the famous Oakley Hall quote in writing, tell a dream, lose a reader. That's why I stress that writing is a waking dream. It's a controlled dream. And most of my dreams would bore me too, you know, as well as, you know, thousands of others.
We're going to start to open this to the audience. You can ask about anything, and you can ask either of us to comment. And while the microphone starts to go around, I want to ask Jim, how does this trilogy in some sense end?
Yes.
How? I mean, how do you bring it, a sequence to an end?
Well, I had no idea until I did it. But it ends by talking about, this sounds like it is really dumb, about immortality. How do you achieve immortality? And that's what it's about.
Wow, how do you achieve immortality?
And stop time.
I mean,
and alter time.
In altered time?
As well. And it's a comic novel, and I'm really serious.
Uh-huh.
So there you go.
Where is Mr. Microphone? Oh, there he is. Okay, yeah. So someone, raise your hand, and the microphone will come to you.
You know, the other thing, while you're doing that, I just want to throw this in. I have to thank Michael. One of the nicest things Michael ever called me, among a lot of other things, Michael once said, I was an enchanted farmer. And I think that in a way that's kind of, I mean, if you meant it, and I took it as a great compliment.
Yes.
In the sense that it's, the stuff is not thought through. It's basically poking holes in the ground and seeing what comes up. Yeah.
So, Jim, what's on your night table right now? What are you reading? Please?
Oh, what am I reading? I just finished a funny little book by Sándor Márai, the Hungarian writer. He did Embers, which is a very traditional book. It's a very traditional 19th, we wrote it in the 20th, but it's a very old-fashioned novel. And then he has a tiny novella called Esther, and I just finished that actually this morning, sitting in the airport. And on the night table...
Wait, he makes it sound like it has 100 syllables, but it's spelled simply M-A-R-A-I-S. I work on the principle that everyone here writes the names of books down and is going to get them at the library or buy all of them because we can't stand to hear about a book we haven't read, huh?
Yeah. I only say it because I was raised with hearing that language, and it's the one language I can half pronounce. I'm also got Love in the Time of Cholera to take. I read about half of it at one point and never got through, so I'm taking another look at that. Graham Greene, The Honorary Consul. and I just finished up a book called Jigsaw by Sybil Bedford. So really eclectic stuff as far as I can see.
this is probably an extremely naive question, but how does reading the works of others help you as a writer?
It's a good question.
It shows you possibilities of where you can go, things you can do that you might not have known. Especially, that's why I like to read experimental fiction. I can't do it. I lose my place when I stretch too far. But it sometimes lets me add on a little bit to where I would go. And it also, of course, reminds you what really good writing is. And it gives you a mark to go to. Michael, what would you say?
I'm not a writer.
Yeah,
what other writers teach me? I'm never not reading.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like. The pleasure for me, I was realizing this over time. You know, I sometimes talk to people who read a book they don't like and they're angry and they say, oh, what a jip. You know, I just read this book. It took forever to read and I didn't like it. One of the things that I discovered, I don't read it all quickly, but I do read around 200 pages a day. And that means that even War and Peace can happen to me in a week. And it doesn't take all summer or all year. And it gives you a full experience that you can live every moment of consciously. And now, you know, when I read a book, it doesn't matter to me whether I liked it or not. What is it? It's just a day or two out of my life. Didn't matter. I love reading various things and not caring about judging them anymore. Not deciding whether they're good or bad. Bad books, I would think, for a writer, teach as much or more as than good books do,
mm-hmm.
because good writing is about making mistakes and then making bigger mistakes, enlarging the mistakes of others until they're the size of an entire book. I mean, that's what it seems to me to write originally is.
I haven't heard this for a while, thank goodness, but years ago when I'd recommend a book to people and they'd say, oh, I can't read that, I have to finish the classics. And I thought, what? You know? Yeah.
When you're first inspired to say something, can you tell how long it's going to be?
I can tell because I can't write more than 200 pages mostly. the way I would phrase it, that helps me phrase it, is there a question I'm asking? Not because I don't have anything I'm saying to. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to ask a question. But seriously, I have, and I don't know at the end what I have to say. So the way I set my goals are really in simple ways. I say, my goal is 150 pages. And whatever it is I'm trying to find out, I want to take 150 pages to say it. And then I'll go from there and see. But it sounds really simple, and it is, but just set a page in a bit and see if you can fill it out and try to make it interesting for yourself.
But I want to point out, you know, I've been around Jim a lot. These books have been written over and over and over again. When you rewrite it, is it because what you've had it in mind to find changes?
No, because I don't have anything in mind. What you're doing, I mean, it's a wonderful question. Writing is the first draft, I always say, and again, you people have heard this, but the first draft is like finding the pieces that you're working with and not seeing how they fit together, putting them up on a table, and you're getting most of them. Some of the pieces you won't be using, and some pieces will be coming later in the mail. And nor do you know what the picture is. If this is a puzzle, you don't even know what it's a picture of. So you start piecing it together. And then I know there are writers who work with much more mastery than I do, but my job as a writer is to kind of grope my way to finding out the subject of what it is I'm writing. And I make a lot of mistakes. I think, oh, it's this, and it turns out not to be. Or I say, oh, this seems to be really important, and it turns out not to be. Early drafts, many of you are writers know, the object of an early draft is to, in a way, keep as many possibilities open for yourself at the beginning, because you don't know necessarily how it's going to turn out. You don't know which the most important ones are going to be. So it takes me a long time to do that. And the great pleasure, and this is the indulgent pleasure, I used to think that if I had to do a lot of drafts of things, it meant I couldn't write, and probably it does. But I used to feel bad about that. And now I honestly take this enormous pleasure in being able to go back into a book again and again and again and kind of solve it, because it's like going into what I hope is a pleasurable dream and being able to, you know, fall asleep, get up in the middle of the night, use the bathroom, and then come right back to the dream again. And that's a wonderful feeling.
I also want to point out to people, Jim has, as a teacher, done some things that I think are both marvelous but shocking, like saying to someone who's been at work on a book for a long time, essentially, this stopped going well years ago, stop it, put it away, put it down, throw it away, start again. And I think that one of the things that you've taught me is that one of the drafts of a book is often a draft that shatters what has become the complacencies and the predictabilities of the book. You've often as not written something until it has the consistency of really thick molasses and it's just not moving at all. And the thing that Jim does is say, you know, get it moving again. Whatever you've put in there that makes everything happen because it has to, because I have to reach that point, we didn't conclude this, get rid of principles of organization that are making the book over-congeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never had a teacher of writing, and it would have saved me a long time, because I kind of had to do that, but I wish I had someone that would just tell me, get rid of it, do this, do that. One of the happiest experiences I had was a couple years ago. My son Henry gave me an idea for a book, and he said, I think, you know, we were riding along somewhere, and he was in the back seat, and he said, I know what the subject for your next book should be. And I said, oh, yeah? And Henry said, yeah, the war between the earth and sky. And I said, huh. But it was odd enough, and it kept with me, that I thought it would be curious. So I wound up writing a novel about the war between the earth and the sky, and it took maybe 6 months. And I got to the end of it, and I looked, and I said, this doesn't work at all. And I was able, and I just put it away, you know, and it was a fabulous feeling. I mean, it was a great feeling to just walk away from it and say, that was an interesting experiment. You know, people talk about, oh, I don't want to write because it takes so much time to write a novel. And the obvious question is, what else are you doing with your time that's so important? I don't see it. So you may as well take some time and take a year or two and write a book, and at least you'll have something at the end of it, you know, as opposed to, what, a bunch of TV reruns.
We have two more questions, I think. Oh, two more questions. My favorite librarian, and the organizer of the series, Louise, instructs us that we have two more questions.
I guess this is for Michael. You had said earlier there was a writer on your show, and he wanted to be on the bestseller list, but you said his book was, I think, too beautiful and too good. Can good writing not be on the bestseller list? And is there something that was on the bestseller list that you thought was good writing?
Okay. First of all, good writing is usually not on the bestseller list. When it is, often as not, it's because there's an understructure, an underlying subject that people regard as scandalous or titillating. Nabokov's Lolita is the example of a very, very great book that was on the bestseller list because people, even in 1952 or 3, were interested in the subject of sex with children, a subject that's become only bigger and more terrifying over the years. But that book was never about sex with children, and anyone who wanted to be titillated by it, maybe at best, said, wow, what a beautiful and amazing book. But most of them just put it away because it wasn't sexy enough. How I wish I could tell you that mass taste was good taste, but it's not. How I wish it seems to me that mass taste, when I was coming up in the late 60s and 70s, mass taste then was better than it is now. Now you go to the movies and they're not even fun. I mean, you know, at least once they were fun, and, you know, a bad movie. But, you know, what's the good of going to something that doesn't even delight or thrill you in a simple, you know, delight and thrill me way. So, you know, rule of thumb, bestseller list, good book, almost never. Almost never. You know, there are sort of exceptions, believe it or not. From time to time, Oprah has chosen pretty good books, and the fact that she chose them is the secret reason it's on the bestseller list. It's like the equivalent of pornography. You know, it put Oprah's, the feeling that people have for Oprah, which is the happiest thing, it seems to me, about Oprah. I mean, imagine this person single-handedly had people all over the country reading Anna Karenina. And then, in a fit of hubris, she had them reading
Faulkner, what were the Faulkner?
As I Lay Dying and The Sound and the Fury. Yeah. And at that point, they kind of rebelled and said, Oprah, we've had it with you. We thought we could trust everything you said. But Faulkner is real, you know, hard. And, you know, it'll take time. Maybe those people will say, I'm going to try that again. Oprah must have recommended it for a reason. And, you know, eventually you spend time with Faulkner. You'll get it. You'll get it. Now, pardon me. This isn't my show. Should I finish this answer? I guess I'll try.
Keep going.
Unfortunately, you remember I said that the intellectuals that we used to have don't exist anymore, the people who knew everything? Nowadays, there was a guy, James Atlas, who said in the New York Times Magazine, tell the truth, aren't we all glad we don't have to read Faulkner anymore? And, you know, that's the time when I thank goodness that there's Oprah. You know, because you know Oprah heard it from Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison's favorite writer is Faulkner, the biggest influence on her. So maybe a New York intellectual doesn't want to read Faulkner anymore, but Toni Morrison told Oprah Winfrey to, and so she told America to, and America gave it a try. Maybe didn't like it as much as it liked Anna Karenina, but still, what a beautiful set of choices. When was the last time you heard a friend of yours trying to choose, what should I read next, Anna Karenina or The Light in August? You know, I felt like I was in dreamland again, where everyone read everything. How wonderful, how beautiful. Yeah. Next question, one more question.
Hi. You talk about urgency. And in your books, I find this strong sense of urgency with a character that sometimes doesn't get immediately fulfilled, and it makes you feel like you're on an urgent journey. How do you sort of keep that going with your writing? Thank you.
That's not so easy. It's when it disappears, I stop. And then I wait and try to figure out what would keep it going. And sometimes these are fairly, I hope, not difficult to read books, but in fact they're sometimes difficult to write because sometimes between paragraphs it's two or three weeks trying to figure out what could possibly happen in the next paragraph that would keep me going. So And I often overshoot the mark where I'll be writing and then I'll look and I'll say, gee, for the last 20 pages, I really haven't done anything. And then as a writer, I just go back to the last, I try to say, go back to the last point I knew where I was, where things were real, and then start it over again. And it's a little bit of a, I won't say it is a discipline, I guess, but it's... not fooling yourself, because as writers, there's two things that happened. In writing, you're dying to get to the end because you want to find out what the end is, and at the same time, it's your job to postpone it. So I play that all the time, and it's a good question. You know, inside is the answer.
Now I want to. Say one thing in addition. I don't know, Jim. This seemed right to me, huh? This seemed to go well.
Yeah, I had a lovely time, and thank you. Thank you, Michael.
You never know. It's very hard to talk to someone you're really close to, especially in front of other people. But I think it went to a lot of places. I wanted to say something about the series. Jim will be in the lobby signing books, and I'll be there just wanting to meet you and say hello and see if we've still remember each other. This series is threatened. Everything is, you know. I woke up one day to get a call from my funders around less than a year ago. And by the end of the talk, I mean, they have been very good to me, but I understood that the funding for my show would be 3/8 of what it had been. That's less than half. This isn't, unfortunately, fiction. This is the world in which money does exist. So as I understand it, there's a bowl out there in the lobby. This isn't a cheap program to produce because many of the writers come from out of town, whole staffs stay late in the library to keep it open. You know, it's a deal. If you like it and you want it, you know, put another $5-$10 in the bowl and, you know, just pretend it's for the next event that you all together, this audience, not you, but this audience can chip in together and pay for the next event because that's what keeps it going. And just like keeping writing going by feeding it another stick of imagination, alas, in the real world, money does exist. And let's feed it a little bit. Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.